Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. This is Justine Rotolo, also known as Miss ADD. I think we're going to have a great show today. Before I talk about Adrian, I just want to remind everyone who lives in the Southern California area to please come by to my adult support group. It's sponsored through CHAD, Children and Adults with ADD. It's Wednesday nights from 7:30 to 9 at the Center for Learning Unlimited, located at 2785 Pacific Coast Highway in Torrance, California. I would love to see as many of you come out and join the growth that's going on in that group. It's just a wonderful group, a lot of love, a lot of support, a lot of acceptance. Also, I want to remind everyone that my book, ADD Land, The Gift of ADD, is for sale, and it's on my website at missadd.com, and it's also on amazon.com. And in addition to that, my podcast can be found archived in Blog Talk Radio /missadd, and also for free on iTunes. All of them are there. Justine Rotolo /missadd. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit about Adrian. She's a writer, she's a speaker, a teacher, a special needs parent advocate, and while her focus is on fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, she also educates parents on brain-based disabilities, or as she calls them, invisible special needs. She has two boys and she lives in North Carolina, so I'm going to bring her on right now. Hi, Adrian. How are you?
Hi, Justine. Thanks. I'm fine.
Good. I'm so happy to have you on the program today.
Thank you.
So would you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you ended up doing what you do?
Sure. Well, I'm going to try to make this not too long a story.
Okay. We have an hour and a half.
Husband and I, about 10 and a half years ago, adopted a little boy who is now 11, almost 12. And we adopted him. We had no reason to think that he had any special needs or anything like that. And through the course of him growing up, we discovered that, in fact, he did have a lot of stuff going on that we had not anticipated. And it was kind of through the course of figuring out what was going on with him, what was the best way to help him, that this whole writing and speaking and educating about special needs, specifically fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, but also pretty much anything neurobehavioral came to be. So in the process, my partner Kay and I, my writing partner Kay and I, edited a book called Easy to Love but Hard to Raise.
Oh, wow. Where's that for sale?
Oh, that's just anywhere. You know, Amazon, I guess, is probably the easiest place to get it. And we started a blog and a Facebook page, Easy to Love but Hard to Raise.
Yes.
I also started writing for a blog called A Mom's View of ADHD, because while my son does not have ADHD, he has fetal alcohol. That was one of his earlier original diagnoses. And so for a long time I was writing about that, and I actually own that blog now, and we have a Facebook page for that. So it's just kind of all come to be. But it was really through finally getting the correct diagnosis for him about, let's see, if he's almost 12. When he was 9, he was diagnosed with PFAS, which is partial FAS, and through learning about the neurobehavioral approach to care for people with FASD, that has actually made our lives a whole lot better, and also given me this new focus which is as
okay,
a trainer.
Okay, so can you first explain to everybody who's listening a little bit about fetal alcohol syndrome?
Sure. I think most people probably know that fetal alcohol, we don't just talk about fetal alcohol syndrome. We talk about fetal alcohol spectrum disorders because fetal alcohol syndrome, in order to be diagnosed with full fetal alcohol syndrome, you need to have some physical anomalies and specifically facial features.
Right.
People can go ahead and Google that if they're interested. And in fact, though, the vast majority of people who have been impacted by alcohol in utero don't have those facial features because they only occur in like a 5-day period in about the third week of pregnancy. And so most people are impacted by it and they don't have those physical features. So a lot of times they go undiagnosed. But anyway, so I don't just talk about fetal alcohol syndrome. I talk about all the spectrum disorders. As the name implies, though, it is caused by alcohol exposure in utero. Lots of times, I think people have misconceptions about how this happens. I think probably people think that kids who have an FASD, their mothers are substance abusers, they're alcoholics, and certainly it does happen with women who are alcoholics or who are abusers of other substances and then also use alcohol. But it's actually kind of sadly easy to expose your child to alcohol prenatally even before you know you're pregnant. So, there's probably a lot of that, and that's another reason why it's so so undiagnosed. It's because it's just not a question that doctors ask of parents when they bring their child in for a behavioral consult. So FASD, alcohol exposure in utero, changes brain development while the baby's brain is forming. It changes it down to the cellular level. So this can be seen in behaviors like slow processing. So if you ask a child question, it seems to take them a long time to answer, that kind of thing. Asking them to do something and them not responding right away, like turn off the TV. I mean, so now everybody in who's listening is going to be like, I asked my kid to turn off the TV and he doesn't do it right away. That wasn't a good example because I think all kids do that, right? But, it takes them a while to process things like language.
Right.
It also can involve a developmental delay. So the rule of thumb is children and young adults with fetal alcohol, we say approximately half their chronological age developmentally. And a lot of times these things don't show up, though, until the child's school age. So it's nothing, even though, you would say, oh, maybe early intervention would catch it. A lot of times they're not able to catch it. It's only when there becomes a big discrepancy between what's expected of the person with FA and what they can actually do that you really start seeing crisis behavior. But basically what we say about FA is, it is a physical special need, right, because our brain is part of our body.
Right.
There's no denying that, and it's brain damage. But it is expressed behaviorally. So a lot of times the only thing you're going to see is behaviors. And when I say behaviors, I think I'm probably talking about unwanted behaviors. So you see things like slow processing, which sometimes can be interpreted as your child ignoring you, or your child being defiant and stuff like that. But in reality, it's their brain just taking longer to process what you've said. You can see things like the developmental delay. So it looks like the child's acting like a baby or being immature, but in reality, we say dismature. So immature implies there's a choice. You know, you could act your age if you wanted to, but dismature says, no, there's not a choice. This is this person's developmental age.
Okay.
Things like emotional inability to kind of regulate emotions. So overreacting to things, kind of the fight or flight is always on.
Right.
What else? I mean, there's a wide variety of behaviors, and they're all associated with different parts of the brain that have been impacted by alcohol.
And so what's very interesting in you speaking about this is that a lot of the symptoms or behaviors that you're seeing could look like ADHD.
They could, right. And a lot of
right.
kids, unless children are identified very early, sometimes children can be identified very early because we know that mom had a problem with alcohol and or they have
right.
facial features. But if kids are identified late, typically they are often first diagnosed with ADHD. Other common diagnoses would be ODD, mood disorder, sometimes developmental delay, sometimes things like reactive attachment disorder if the child is adopted, things like that.
Yes.
Which isn't to say the people who diagnose the child with those things, it's not to say they're wrong exactly.
Right.
It's more that it's a bigger picture thing. Once you look at it all overall and you say, oh, this is brain damage caused by alcohol exposure, it gives you a very different picture of what's going on with that person.
Have you ever seen the diagnosis and then also, co-occurring diagnoses with it? So you have the spectrum, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, and then you can also have ADD or ODD or...
So FASD is really a whole brain thing. So I said, it's not that those ADHD symptoms aren't there.
Okay.
They are there. It's not that ODD is tricky because ODD, is oppositional defiant disorder.
Right.
And a lot of times that is our interpretation of what's going on versus what is actually going on. It also is, if you can imagine this, so you're a child and you have brain damage and nobody understands that and nobody's helping you. They're just, saying stuff like you could do it if you wanted to, you should try harder or we're going to punish you and you're getting punished for your brain damage. You might be a little oppositional and defiant too. So ODD is tricky for me, but, I mean, all those boxes are ticked. It's just, if you look at the big picture, we're talking about fetal alcohol and kind of the way that we approach it is different maybe than the way you would approach someone who had, classic ADHD.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. I understand. So when you work with, parents and trying to help them with brain-based disabilities, for example, and ADHD is one of them.
Yeah.
And so somebody comes to you, as people come to me all the time, and they have, along with ADHD, they were diagnosed with co-occurring of depression, anxiety, and, oh, my God, the oppositional defiant disorder. And everybody's screaming and yelling in the house. So what do you do? What do you tell parents to
do? Well, so what we want to talk, when we talk about fetal alcohol, and I actually think that this applies to almost all the other possible diagnoses, including, you name it. You're probably more familiar than I am, but it's I really feel like it's important to suss out what is the primary characteristic of this disorder, versus what is the reaction this person is having by not getting the needs of that primary thing met, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So for the way it might work for fetal alcohol would be I talked a little bit about processing. I talked about developmental delay. Let's talk about sensory integration stuff.
Oh, yes, the big one.
That's very, very common in people with FA. If your sensory system is part of your central nervous system, and if you're exposed to alcohol in utero, it's not just your brain, it's your entire central nervous system. So let's say it's something sensory that's happening. Here's a good one. So this is from my friend Tina. This is a true story of her son. So her son is 7, I think, and he is in school, And this happened to him. He was in school, and they said your child can't sit and read for 10 minutes at a time. And I think people who are listening whose kids have ADHD say, well, that's just kind of how it is. That's par for the course. But it actually turned out this little boy at home could love to read, and he would sit and read for 20, 30 minutes at a time.
Wow.
No problem. But at school he couldn't do it, and he would get up and he'd walk around and he'd be unable to focus and he'd bug other kids and he'd go look out the window, and the teachers just were really like, what do we do? He just won't do it. And so one phrase that we talk about with fetal alcohol is it's not won't, it's can't. Right?
Right.
It's not that he's choosing not to do it. He can't do it. So what we want to do is look at why can't he do it. So what's going
okay.
on in that room that is keeping him from focusing?
Right.
And so my friend went in, and she just sat and observed for a while. And what she noticed was there's a lot of movement happening in the room. I mean, all the kids were mostly sitting and reading, but then, someone had to get up to go to the bathroom, and someone had to do this, and someone had to da 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 da. So that was kind of overstimulating him. But the other thing was, the hallway next to this classroom was the last hallway before kids would go to when they were going out to recess, right?
Oh,
so
okay.
No matter how much the parents try to keep try to keep the kids quiet, the closer you get to that door, the excitement
right.
builds. So the hallway or that wall of the room, there was just always a lot of rumbling and noise. It's one of these cement block walls that you could still
yeah.
hear. And so even though for almost all the other kids in the class and the teachers, they didn't even notice it. They didn't notice the hall passing noise.
Right.
This little boy, he is very hyper aware in terms of things that he hears. So
okay.
this was what was doing it, was this noise, the movement of the room and this noise. So, and I'm going to get to the end of your question soon. But so, the answer to your question. So what they did, because I want to talk about what they did, and then I want to talk
yeah.
about what could have happened. Because what they did took his needs into mind. They saw what caused it. And they thought of an accommodation, which is, a solution that took his brain function in mind that didn't cost anything. It was so easy. All they did was all day long in that classroom now, they play classical music. And they play it really low.
Oh,
wow. It's not super loud. They play it really low. It doesn't bother any of the other kids. And it just keeps kind of this threshold of predictable noise for him. So that he is
what a
not
great idea.
I know. It was so
easy. And recently I had also heard, just to throw this in, that classical music is used many times to help children focus.
Sure. Well, it helped him focus.
Yeah,
yeah.
I just recently heard that. So that's very interesting.
It kept him from hyper-focusing on the other stuff, the distracting stuff. Okay. But
wow.
I think you asked how to differentiate, though, and then we talk about the really unwanted behaviors, the screaming, the tantruming, like how do we differentiate between that? So let's talk about if this little boy was in a classroom where they didn't think, why is he doing this? They just saw that he was doing it. So he kept getting up out of his seat. He wasn't doing as they asked. What if they had reacted in a more punitive way? What
right.
if they had made assumptions about his motivation? Like, he's not paying attention. He's ignoring us. He's being defiant, because they kept saying, sit down, and he wouldn't sit down.
Right.
He's doing it on purpose, work avoidant, work refusal, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so in many classrooms around the country, if a child did these things, what they would do is they'd start on a behavioral plan.
Exactly.
start and sometimes behavioral plans can be positive, but
right.
they're never universally positive. I mean, there's always some negative in there. So they would start punishing him. Okay. So
okay.
in this little boy's case, it really wouldn't have mattered what they did. They couldn't get him. They wouldn't have been able to make him do the task at hand, which is to sit and read quietly, because he simply couldn't. He simply
right.
couldn't, because he was so distracted by this other stuff. He has hyper awareness of noise, and he was so distracted by it. So by punishing him for it, he would have eventually, you know, he would have felt terrible about himself and
right.
Probably started acting out, you know, depending on the individual person, how you act out as an individual to you. You know, he would have been frustrated, angry. He would have, you know, really felt like his teachers didn't understand him and they didn't like him. And the teachers in turn also would have become very frustrated, of course, because
right.
their tried and true behavioral methods, which really do work with most kids. I'm not suggesting we stop the carrot stick mode of
no.
organizing behavior, because with most kids that does work.
Right.
But with this kid, it just wouldn't. So that's when you would see him starting to be frustrated and act out. And the same thing happens in a home environment, right? Probably even more so, because at home, I mean, I know as a parent, I don't act professional around my kids all that often, you know. So I'm much more likely, if I'm frustrated or tired or whatever, to fly off the handle and
yeah.
yell, I think, more yeah. than a teacher would.
Right. So
I mean, I don't want to imply that people are creating these unwanted behaviors in their kids, especially, you know, I know that a lot of people have crisis situations at home, but I also want to suggest that perhaps by doing things differently, we
right.
might avoid some of them. So
that's exactly right.
Thinking,
yeah.
why is my kid acting this way? Maybe
right.
if I just back down a bit, you know.
Right.
We as parents, we want to be the authorities. We want to be the people in charge. We want to make
right.
sure they know who's boss. And
right.
sometimes that can work against us, especially if
you
have a child kind of chronically frustrated.
It doesn't
really do them any favor.
It's very interesting, because I'm working with a family right now who has a little 7-year-old, and I picked up sensory integration with her. So she's going to get some occupational therapy. But along with that, what I told the parents just the last time we were together is, you know, when you want them to pick up their toys, it doesn't have to be in an authoritative way. You can make a game of it. Like, I bet you can beat her to do, you know what I mean? Let's make a game of all these things. And
right.
a lot of parents will push back a little bit because, as you just said, they want the children to know who the hierarchy is. Well, you know what? They
mm-hmm.
know that. And it's
mm-hmm.
okay to have fun with your children and to make games out of things that may be frustrating for them.
Well, and also, you know, for kids with ADHD, for kids with fetal alcohol, for kids with other kind of brain dysfunction, that for things like pick up your room, if you
right,
really
exactly.
break down what it takes
right.
to pick up your room,
that's right.
there's
that's
so
right.
many different things
yep.
that might stop these kids up. You know, first of all, how messy is the room, right? I mean,
right.
a lot of times as parents, we ignore, I mean, this is how I am. I'll just speak for myself, is I will go a couple weeks and then all of a sudden focus in on, oh, my gosh, this room is insane, right? Like,
right.
How did I let it get this way? And then and so if it looks like that to me,
right.
how does it look like to them? You know, these might be people, kids who have trouble with executive functioning. So they,
right.
they're disorganized. They don't know where to start. They
right.
can't even break down the tasks, you know. So.
Right.
You know, making it into a game or just doing it with them and not
exactly.
And then also changing your attitude about what you have to do. I think that's also crucial, right?
Yeah.
It's like not. I mean, I'm guilty of this. You know, okay, I'll help him break it down, but I'll do it and kind of I'll be kind of annoyed when I'm doing it. Like, you know.
I remember
okay,
those
the
days.
Do the Lego, you know, but just to also change our attitudes, like, all right,
yeah.
this is, you know, we just have to do this. If I really want the kid to clean the room, this is really what I have to do, is I have to help him. I have to break it down. I have to maybe
right.
do it with him if he needs that
right.
kind of support. Maybe right. I also, when he's not home, need to go in. I mean, if your kid won't overreact, some kids get really upset if you do this. But my son, if his room is really trashed and I clean it while he's gone, he is always like, "Oh wow, this looks great." I mean, that's actually pretty rewarding to me.
Which is great because it makes us feel good, right?
Yeah.
You know,
then,
the other thing,
like I can. Go ahead.
The other thing I just wanted to say, what I did with my own kids, believe me, I wasn't the perfect parent. They're 26 and 23 now, they'll tell you that. But one of the things I did with their room is I took them out with me to IKEA, and I said, okay, let's talk about what you would like to have in your room so that everything has a place. Because I think sometimes, I know for myself, and because I'm ADHD, I know that when I try to organize, I need to have a place for everything, or the whole thing kind of falls apart. And that was something that was very successful with my boys, is we had enough shelves and we had enough bookcases, you know, little ones. They didn't have big rooms. I don't want it to sound like we had a mansion, because we didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But I made sure that they had a place for everything, so that when I asked them, hey, guys, you know, your room's starting to look like, you know, a little crazy here. So do you remember what we did, how we put this together, what goes over there? You know, I'd break it down, and I would help them at the same time. But they loved the fact that there was a place for everything. And I just wanted to throw that out for people who are listening, because I think sometimes we have a lot of stuff, but we don't have enough places to put it.
I think that's a great strategy. Another strategy that is sometimes helpful for kids with, or anybody really, with fetal alcohol, because kids with fetal alcohol grow up to be grown-ups with fetal alcohol.
Yes, it's like ADD.
So a lot of times one difficulty for people with fetal alcohol is they can get the piece but not the picture. And so so saying go clean your room, I mean, so I would say this to my son, go clean your room. And he'd go upstairs, and our house is too far, so he'd go upstairs, and he would, and then he'd come right back down. And I would say, there's no way you cleaned your room. I mean, there's no way you did it. And he would say, I did, I cleaned my room. And so I'd go up, and of course it would look the same to me. And I would say, what did you do? And he'd say, well, I straightened my blanket or something. So to him, and I know this sounds, for people who don't have close connections with someone with FA, this might sound like I'm exaggerating, but really, he is such a literal thinker. He's so concrete that when I said, go clean your room, he did. He went up and he cleaned something, right? He straightened his sheets, or he put two Legos in the Lego bucket or whatever.
I love it.
To him, that was, I clean my room. So what he needed, really, and what we discovered that he needed, not only is for help to do it with him and to break it down into the pieces, but for a lot of times people with fetal alcohol, their visual strengths are much higher than really any of their other strengths.
Oh, wow.
And once you get the room clean, if you can take a picture of the room or the different parts of the room
and
post it, This is clean, right? This is what I mean by clean. It needs to look like this. So then there's a reference. And that can be very, very effective. Because that's the other thing. What is clean? Clean is abstract. I mean, you know what clean means. I know what clean means. I know what I think clean means. But do they really know what clean means, especially if they're very concrete thinkers, right? I cleaned my room.
Right.
To the parent, if you don't know this is what's going on, you can feel like your kid's trying to con you. But it's actually really their experience.
Yes. Yeah, and I definitely agree with that. The other thing is when you talk about clean, so I had another little girl that I was seeing. This was years ago, but her mother told her to go clean her room one day, so she got the Windex, and she started spraying the room with Windex. Because
that's right. Right.
That was cleaning. And the mother was very upset, and I was like, no, she's very literal.
She sees
you clean. Yeah.
Yeah. And then
so I think
tests,
how we say things
whole,
to them.
The whole developmental, not just developmental in terms of, you know, like I said, half chronological age, but just I also have a 14-year-old. He'll be 15 in a month, almost 15-year-old.
That's exciting.
Completely neurotypical in every way. And it's really only been, I would say, in the past 6 months that he has done any kind of voluntary organization of his room whatsoever. So
wow.
Up until, even though he's completely neurotypical, you know, up until 14 and a half, it was always like, I had to be specific. Go clean your room. This is not clean enough. You have to do this part. You have to do that part. And
right.
just because he didn't care, it didn't have an import to him.
Right.
So there's also that whole level too, right? I mean, so we can talk about the disorder and we can talk about brain function, but then we also have to consider, like, how do regular 11-year-olds act, or how do typical 7-year-olds do
yeah,
too?
Yeah, I mean,
you know.
It's just normal. This is why sometimes I believe there's an overdiagnosis sometimes of a lot of different things when it's really, like I say to parents all the time, let's look at what's normal, and then let's look of above normal, because a lot of things, kids not being able to sit in their seats and stuff like that when they're very little, sometimes that can be very normal stuff. I mean, you know, why we really have to look at what's normal. I have a question, though, and this is from me. Because I have a lot of situations, both my boys had disabilities, ADHD, and my other son was also ADHD on the autistic spectrum, and then my older son now has bipolar 2. So they had equal time spent on their disabilities, okay? But how about the families like yours, where your older son is okay and doesn't have the neurobiological issues and all that? How did you parent so that he didn't feel kind of left out? I have a lot of kids that I see where the siblings are kind of feeling like, well, this kid's getting all the attention because it's like the
right.
IC, you know?
Well, I should probably ask my almost 15-year-old if this is even accurate, because I don't know that he would say, oh, yeah, she did a good job at that or not. But, I mean, I certainly, you know, my younger son, the one with fetal alcohol, he's extremely intense. He is extremely needy. He's extremely noisy. He, when you're around him, you know, he becomes the focus. So I think, you know, we've had to pay extra attention to our needs as a whole family in terms of how that can draw focus. So one thing, and this is really, I know for a lot of your listeners, this is going to seem like kind of a possibly difficult solution for them. But one thing is, so my younger son, when he was halfway through second grade, we pulled him out of school to homeschool. And because he just really, the traditional classroom just really, really was very difficult for him in a whole lot of ways. So we pulled him out to homeschool. And then my older son, about at the end of his school year, he was in sixth grade, he said, can I homeschool too? And I said, why? You know, you are so good at school. And, you know, he's the kid who I would get that note. You know, he's a pleasure to have in class, et cetera. And I thought, well, gosh, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But he said, so he was on the opposite end of the spectrum, though. He said, I'm bored in school.
Wow.
He said, Mommy, during school, I read a book every day. And I was like, well, that's good. He said, no, listen to me. I have enough time in my school day, so I read an entire novel every day.
Wow.
And I thought, and he said, I want to have control of my free time.
Wow.
If I have free time like that. And I thought, okay, well, I guess that's a pretty good argument for it.
Yeah.
So, but what has been the really nice benefit of this, the homeschooling, is that my younger son, the one with fetal alcohol, he spends a lot of the time out of the house. So we get babysitter because I work at home. My older son does school at home. My husband works in the house and out of the house. In order for us to work, my younger son needs to not be here because he's so intense.
Yeah.
We can't like work and keep half an eye on him. That just doesn't work. So when we need to work, he you know, we have babysitters and my family lives near and they're really helpful.
Which is great.
He goes to different homeschooling activities and classes and stuff like that. So what it has done is it gives me mostly, but sometimes my husband too, one-on-one time with our teenage son.
That's nice.
I think that we probably spend a lot more time with him than the majority of parents of 14-year-old boys spend one-on-one with their kids. And so
they need that. They need that. Teenagers need that time with their parents.
So I think that that has really helped the situation. You know, it wasn't purposeful. It wasn't like, you know, if we do this, we'll get time with our older son. It just kind of worked out that way. And but I think that that has been, that's really the best thing. But I mean, does everybody have to, you know, pull their kids out of school and work at home for this to happen? I don't know. I mean, that's, you know, that's really difficult, but I think to be aware of it is probably a big step.
Yeah, and that's something that I usually have the whole family come in so we can talk about it too, because it's very interesting to hear from the kids their perspective of the family. And then if you talk to the parents alone, a lot of times the perspective is totally different. And I just love to hear the kids talk about how they feel about things that are going on in the house.
I
didn't know that.
Maybe I should have my son call you. you can ask him. Because I don't know how accurate this is, if he really feels like that too. But, you know, he has activities. On Saturday, my husband basically spends the whole day taking him to, he does robotics and things like that. And he,
Is he social? Does he have friends?
My older son?
Yeah. Oh, great. Okay. No, because sometimes when they're homeschooled, my concern as they get older is they just have enough friends. That's all. Yeah.
Yeah. No, he has friends. Actually, we were talking about that the other day because I always tease him that his mom is his best friend. You know, he just rolls his eyes. He thinks I'm ridiculous, of course, because I'm his mother and he's 14. And he was like, no, remember I went out. He probably goes out socially, you know, 2 to 3 times a week. And then, of course, you know, Justine, that kids now, I don't want to seem like a really old fart, but I think that kids now with the social media and the ability to use the computers, you know, he Skypes with, I remember when I was a kid, I would have these phone marathons with my friends. I would spend, you know, 5-6 hours on the phone. Everyone would be screaming at me to get off the phone because they wanted to use it. They do that too, but they do it via Skype.
That's great.
You know, IM, and so he has all that. And the other thing about homeschooling is he doesn't have to get up, you know, at 6 a.m. So
which is great.
Yeah, so he's able to stay up really late.
That's nice.
Yeah, it is. I think he's doing fine socially.
That's great.
Actually, yeah.
So talk to me a little bit about what you do with parents when they come, they talk to you. Do you, you're a teacher, but do you work with parents directly?
Well, right now what I do is I teach a specific curriculum about fetal alcohol as a neurobehavioral disorder. It was a curriculum created by Diane Malbin through Facets. Diane is a social worker, and she's been working with families and teaching people about FA for about 20 years. And she's created this curriculum that I was lucky enough to become a trainer in her method. So that's what I do, but I'm also starting next month, I'm starting a little certification program. I should probably get it straight before I start it. To be a parent coach. And I think after that I'll be able to do more one-on-one with people. I mean, I do that informally now, of course.
Okay.
But I just don't do it professionally. Go ahead.
Do you use a lot of your, you know, what you've done with your son in helping other people?
Yeah, the class that I teach is very much you know, we use a lot of specific examples and stories. And also, you know, the proof is in the pudding, right? We have a child who, at age 8, this is before he was diagnosed, we were We went and visited therapeutic treatment centers because we just didn't know how we were going to live in the house with him. Things were very bad. He was extremely frustrated, angry, aggressive. But we also had no tools to understand what was going on at all. We were approaching everything as if, we could somehow get him to stop it. If we just went to the right therapy or we found the right medication, we would miraculously make it better. And so through the diagnosis and then through understanding his brain function and, like I said at the beginning of the call, kind of sussing out what is he doing that is a result of his brain function, and then what is he doing that's a reaction to his needs not being met, right? We call those primary characteristics. Those are the brain function, directly related brain function, and we call them secondary characteristics. And secondary characteristics are like the things that you take your kid to the psychiatrist for, right? Like mood disorder, tantruming, depression, stuff like that. And really, if you think about it, if your needs are not met over time, you are going to become depressed. You're going to tantrum. Yeah. So we just didn't have any framework to understand any of that at all. And so, but through getting him diagnosed and through, I went to the training that I do. I've been to the training a couple times, and through doing that, we had tools that we could use and understanding of him that have really, really turned things around. And I would not, we don't have perfect days. Like today was kind of a not perfect day.
Okay.
but we have more good days than bad days, and we certainly understand them a lot better now. And,
you talk a little bit about the tools that you've used? Like, if he was tantruming out or, processing issue. Can you talk about some of the tools? Because I don't know about you, but being on Facebook and, just reading other people, and there's so many women out there, men out there, that have children that are just really struggling. I had a woman the other night contact me just to say her child was also autistic. And, she was really wanting to know what we were going to be talking about today. And I just really want to talk about, in the world of your world, my world, the difficult child, and what tools you would want to give to people to help with that.
Okay, so all my tools have to do with understanding that particular child's brain function, right? So I think that this can apply to a child with autism, a child with ADHD, a child with, overwhelming sensory problems. So the key is, not in the moment when you're like all worked up and, your kid is just the pillow at you or whatever. But if you can kind of get some time to separate and think about what are my child's areas of difficulty? Like when do the bad things always happen? Okay.
Okay.
So to kind of work out like scenarios where things always go wrong and why that might be. So I'm going to talk about processing because that is just for processing speed. Because for people with fetal alcohol, this is almost always a main area of difficulty.
ADHD. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So in order for your brain to process information at the same speed as neurotypical people, it means that all those millions of cells, all the millions and billions of brain cells in there have to work lightning fast, right?
Right.
And so if anything slows that down, like you have fewer synapses or your brain is not organized the same as typical people, if anything that slows that down, that means your processing is slower, okay? That's like the non-neuroscientist explanation of processing speed. Okay, so here's an example in my house of how this might go down. And I'll kind of point out that, when I say tools, I just kind of mean, like, how my understanding has changed and how I changed my reaction.
Okay.
So I might be folding laundry. Here's a typical scenario for every woman in America. You know, I'm folding laundry and I'm doing laundry and I need my kids' dirty laundry.
Right.
And this is something that my son, despite his developmental delays, despite his cognitive difficulties, he can go get his dirty laundry. Like, this is a task I know he can do. Right.
Yes.
So that's the first thing is what are you asking them to do, and can they really do it?
Right. Right.
I mean, really, is it something where they always have a meltdown, or can they do it sometimes? So we know that I know that my son can go get his dirty laundry. That's not a problem. He's been able to do that for a while. It's not a problem in that he can actually go do it eventually, but it's always met with great resistance. Right. Like I've asked him to, you know, go write a novel or something in 10 minutes. So I say, Jamie, can you please go upstairs and get your laundry? And he'll say no. Okay. So if you ask your child to do something and they say no, or they say shut up, which is another common response to this request, the first thing that happens is you're no longer concerned about the laundry, right?
Right.
Your concern now is I'm going to make that kid, you know, I'm going to, you can't talk that way to me. You know, you start interpreting this behavior. They're being oppositional. They're being defiant. Shut up. Like, you don't say that to me. You don't talk to your mom that way. So anyway, so it's easy to kind of spiral into this whole judgment of how they're behaving. And judgment based on your past experience, I'm not saying this is unusual to act this way about, you know, if your kid acts this way, to respond that way. This is a normal response to a child who talks that way to their parent, right?
Exactly, yes.
Trying to make people feel like what they're doing is wrong.
No.
Because it's normal to react that way. When I tell this story to anybody, any group of parents, everybody's always like, oh, no, he didn't. Okay. Here's the thing, though. All right. So if I say to my son, go upstairs and get your dirty clothes, the fact is that I've said this to him. It's going to actually take him several more seconds than most people to even understand what I just said to him. Right.
Right.
So
right.
One of the phrases we also talk about with fetal alcohol is a 10-second kid in a 1-second world. So
okay.
A typical kid, if I said, go get your dirty laundry, they would say, okay, or do I have to, or whatever, you know, they would have some response.
Right.
But this kid, he doesn't even know what I've, so he says no before he even knows what I've asked. Right.
Wow.
So here's the tool for this. And that is, no matter what comes out of their mouth, just wait.
Right.
Right? So this is how it goes down. Jamie, please go get your dirty laundry. No. Then I wait. I don't respond to no. I mean, and at first, it was really hard not to respond to no. At first, I had to, like, you know, clench my fists and count myself. but if I waited that extra beat, you know what he... Every single time, Justine, every single time, he would go up and get his laundry.
Wow.
Every single time. So it wasn't him being defiant. It wasn't that he wasn't willing. It wasn't that he wasn't able. It's that he needed time to process. And that was just something he, you know, was just like this knee-jerk response. He probably, he's been saying that ever since he learned it, no. You know, at 2. And so it was just kind of buying him time. It wasn't consciously buying him time. Like, he wasn't thinking, if I say no, then in 10 seconds I'll know what she said. But it was just buying him time. So So when I talk about a tool, I'm talking about understanding his processing speed. And then the tool is for me to control myself and not overinterpret his actions, to give him the time he needs.
Right.
Because if the point is get your dirty laundry and then I go off on you can't talk to me that way, that whole processing speed thing is lost.
Right.
And also, if I start screaming at him about you can't talk to me that way, there's more processing. I mean, you know, then that's when you see the big blowout, because he doesn't know why I'm so mad. Why is she so mad at me?
Right.
You know, I don't even know what she asked me. so that's what I mean by focusing on that child's individual difficulties and thinking about strategies to manage that in yourself.
Right.
Because that's really what it's about. And guess what? So now, after a couple of years now of go get your laundry, no, and then I wait a minute, 9 times out of 10 now, if I say, Jamie, go get your laundry, he'll either say, give me a minute, because we've given him substitute words, right? Once
Great.
We figured out what the no and the shut up were, we realized that he needed to say something then, but no and shut up were not appropriate, of course. You
right.
know, we didn't want to hear that. So we just practiced giving him different words.
That's awesome.
Right? Give me a minute, I need some time. So he'll say, give me a minute, I need some time. And sometimes he'll say, okay, and he'll go and do it.
Wow.
So it really, I mean, and it's taken a long time, but it really
right.
has made a difference. And just, you know, everyday interactions like that in your household, if you're having a child who is constantly, you know, this is why they call it oppositional defiant disorder. It seems like every single thing you do, they're saying no to.
Right.
It might not be because they want to say no. It might be for some other reason, like
right.
the processing, or like it seems like too much, or they're in a state of complete frustration all the time, and so
yeah.
they're very negative, you know. So
yeah.
there's just to kind of try and tease that out. Where is the area of difficulty, and how can I act differently as a parent to just make that moment go a little better?
So then I think it would really be a good idea for everybody who's listening, if your child was diagnosed with ADHD and or on the autistic spectrum, or, you know, have the co-occurring disorders of ODD or depression, anxiety, I think if you can really understand how their brain function is and how it works, So would you suggest, and I know I'm sure there's a lot of people that are probably say, oh, my God, I could never afford this, but neuropsychological exams kind of look at the brain patterns, you know, a real extensive one. I actually had one done on my younger son at U of M when we lived in Ann Arbor, and insurance actually covered the whole thing because mm-hmm. we were able to write it off as visits, you know.
Yeah.
And it really helped me so much to understand. You know, they did the Rorschach test, and, you know, I learned a lot about how when they kind of put the bat up to him, he couldn't process emotion. So all that was just very interesting for me to understand what he needed in the parenting world.
Well, and I think a neuropsych test is a great idea, but again, like you said, it can be
very expensive,
and so we've been really lucky in that our insurance covers it too. And I think this may have to do with our practice. They code it as a specialist visit, so it's covered that way. I don't, and I maybe shouldn't talk about this because I don't want to, you know, jinx
right.
it or anything. But it has been covered for him. But I think
okay.
that it, you know, if that, because it really can be like several thousand dollars, and if your insurance doesn't cover it, that can. But the schools also, when the schools do testing, like if you've requested your child
right.
be considered for an IEP, the schools do testing. So to get a hold of that and to
right.
look at what that test results say. But the other thing is to educate yourself about what are the common characteristics of my child's disorder. What are the common brain difficulties? So for ADHD,
right.
you know, we have executive functioning. What is
right.
executive functioning? What does that mean? And
yeah.
so in that area, for example, that's a place where your child's going to need. I feel kind of silly telling people this because I feel like everybody knows this. But you know, in those areas, that's where your child's going to need extra help. And
yes.
there's no shame in needing the extra help. And they might need that extra help their whole life.
And they do.
And so right, and it's not about enabling and calming.
No.
No. And for people who are, you know, my son also has low IQ, so I tend to think of like low IQ, you know, cognitively low, cognitively high. But for most people with ADHD, just kind of being able to identify those areas of difficulty and then have, you know, be given tools and workarounds. And
right.
So, you know, my whole life I'm going to need to have my
schedule kind of broken down for me.
My whole life I might need a visual if I'm trying to replicate something or keep something clean, that kind of stuff.
Right. And, you know, here's the interesting thing. So, yes, executive function is very big in ADHD. And then what happens is there's a lot of different – the way our neurons fire, we can throw off different chemicals in our brain. And so besides the executive function, there can be other things that are going on and can cause different types of symptoms. So it's not like when I have kids that come in, I can tell you that in the course of a day when I have clients, and I had five of them this morning, everybody's different.
Right.
You know, it's not like it's a cookie cutter kind of thing.
Right.
Even though we all have executive function, it manifests itself differently in different children.
Right. And so that's what I'm saying is, you know, look at your individual child. Find out about the characteristics and then say, which of these really apply to my individual child?
Right.
You know, and then if that applies to my individual child, this is where I'm going to need to give him or her help versus this is something where I'm always going to come down hard on them, or this is somewhere where we have to, you know, we're going to keep punishing him on this particular thing until he gets it right. Because the giving help, accommodations, is actually empowering people because it helps them know where they have areas of difficulty. And by you giving them support, you're showing them where they might need support in the future and when they become more independent as a you know, as an adult. So
the thing I want to say to people who are listening too is, and I don't know if you've experienced this, but I do a lot. A lot of parents really don't want to talk about it. They don't want their children to tell people. You know, a lot of people don't want to do 504 plans or IEPs because they feel like there's a stigma. Well, here's what I want to say, and I'm really passionate about this. When my boys were growing up, I taught them how to embrace their ADD and my other son with his NLD, nonverbal learning disability. And I really taught them to understand what this was all about and what they needed, how important it was that they had accommodations, to the point where I had teachers who would come up to me and say, I think it's great. They come up to us and they ask us, they remind us that they have accommodations. See,
right.
I think if we empower our children, and this isn't, you know, a death sentence, as of course my book says it's a gift, and there truly is a creative side to this that's amazing, but there's also the negative symptoms. But if you educate your children about them and you're educated and you don't hide from it because of fear that what are people are going to say or think, then your children are going to do so much better in life.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
I don't know if you see a lot of that, but I do. I see a lot of people who just want to do the hush-hush thing, you know.
Well, in the fetal alcohol community, you know, most of our kids, especially as they become older, the differences are more obvious for many of the kids, not for all of them. One other myth about fetal alcohol is that all the kids are low intelligence, or all the people. I keep saying kids, but there's many more adults living with it because they're all grown up. And that's actually not true. The majority of people with fetal alcohol are within the range of normal, quote-unquote normal IQ. And people can be average or above average IQ with FA. So my personal experience is with a child who's lower on the IQ end. So his difficulties, after you spend a little time with him, I think you figure it out. But we don't, you know, I don't try to hide anything about it anymore.
Which is great.
And it's actually, and I know one worry is people people think that their kids will feel different or, you know, feel like they're drawing attention to themselves. The fact is my son already feels different.
Yeah.
You know, he feels very different than the other kids. And so to kind of acknowledge it, like, you know what? You're right. The feelings that you had are true. You know, this, I'm going to acknowledge that and validate that. And this is why. So, you know, we talk about the brain and we talk about fetal alcohol, you know, as much as he can understand it. And it, I think that helps him. So he doesn't have to say, I'm bad. I'm a bad person. He can think, oh, I have difficulties in my brain. And this is why, you know.
Does he have friends? Does he have, you know, kids that he plays with? And
yeah, he has. I mean, social. This is an area of difficulty for him. Is socialization, and also he's 11 and developmental. He's about 6.
Right.
So that's actually where homeschooling has helped out a lot, because most of the play dates and things like that, play groups for homeschool are mixed age. You know, you're never going to have like a 5th grade play date.
Right.
You just have, you know, park day or something like that, and then all the kids of all ages go, and it's really common for kids of all ages to participate in a game or something like that, so he's able to do that. And he does have a couple kind of close buds. You know, we've been careful about figuring out who's a good match for him, and I think after 11 years or 10 years, we finally figured it out, so...
So tell me something. How can you figure out for people who are listening what your child with, you know, with this syndrome can, not syndrome, what did you call it, spectrum, what they can do and what they are incapable of doing? So like you said, you know, Jamie can go and get his laundry, his dirty laundry.
Right.
You know that he can do that.
Yeah.
So how did you figure out other things, if you would mind giving examples of other things that you knew he couldn't do, and what did you do about that?
Oh, so things that he can't do. So
yeah.
he can't do money. He has no sense of money.
Okay.
And so what did I do about that? There's nothing I can do about that.
Yeah.
I mean,
I mean, is there
at this time?
Is there anything that you like? I understand he doesn't get money, but. What I'm trying to ask you, I guess I'm not being clear, for parents who are listening, when parents get angry because go get your laundry, and the child turns around and says no or shut up, and they're not recognizing what this is all about. This is a processing issue, okay?
Yeah.
But when a child can't do something, like you give your child $5 and say, go get a drink over there, and the child's like, what? How did you determine what you knew he couldn't do?
How did I determine what I knew he couldn't do?
You know, like, what? How did you know he couldn't do money, for example?
Well, I think, first of all, if I gave him money and I said, go get something, he could do that. But understanding what the abstract concept of what is $5 or what is $1 or counting money and things like that, that's pretty abstract. I think just by observing him, I'm not understanding the question.
See, I think there's probably people that are listening, because I know for myself, if I was listening to this show, I would be saying, okay, I get the fact that there are things that Jamie's able to do, and the way he responds may have to do with his inability to process something the way we do, okay? But how would I know if I had a child what they could do and what they couldn't do?
So you kind of knew what you needed to take action on and what you didn't?
Right.
Okay, all right, that's a great question. And here my response is that if you're meeting resistance, if they're saying they can't do it, if you're seeing kind of unwanted behaviors around it, give them the benefit of the doubt.
Okay.
My advice to people is, and it can feel as a parent, this feels uncomfortable, right?
Okay. Right.
It really does. But if the more that you give them the benefit of the doubt and assume it's brain function, the more your child will actually achieve success. And so what happens is if you have a child who has difficulties kind of in every aspect of their life, what you can create is kind of this this kind of nasty onion effect. So you have this child in the middle, and they have difficulties, and you can't tell which are things they really have difficulties in and which they're trying to play you and be manipulative.
Right.
And so you put your judgment on that. Like, you're being manipulative. You're playing me. You're doing this to push my buttons. Okay, so you have that layer of judgment. And then you have that child feel frustrated and angry. Because maybe sometimes they were just kind of being bratty, but maybe a lot of times they weren't. Maybe a lot of times it was because it was so difficult for them. So,
right.
So then there's this layer of, like, frustration and anger. And then, of course, you have the parent's layer of frustration and anger. And this gets repeated over and over and over again. And that's why I call it a nasty onion, because you have all these layers.
Right.
Judgment and frustration
right.
and anger. And in the core of it is this kid, right? So
right.
what you really need to do is just try hard as you can to drop the judgment and anger on these, on what they're doing or they're not doing, and give them the benefit of the doubt. And then over time, as things settle and everybody's done being really angry at each other and sick of each other, and then you can see. So it's hard. You can't really see. If you're in the middle of a crisis situation and you're unhappy and you feel like things are really bad, that's really not a time, I think, when you can determine, like, what is brain and what is
right, right.
kid
and
being
see,
kid.
I don't know. Maybe it's because I have ADHD, but when I work with kids and, you know, I hear stories from their parents about how they behave, you know, I am always looking for reasons for things, and because I just am not judging these children. I know growing up with it myself, it was very difficult for me. I wasn't at times doing well in school. It wasn't that I wasn't very bright, but I had, you know, the executive function issue, and I knew that that didn't make me feel real good about myself. And when you don't feel good about yourself, you can act out all over the place, and especially
right.
as you get older. And, you know, for example, this morning I had a parent who brought her daughter in, and they were saying, you know, she had a terrible morning. And I said, so, honey, what did you have for breakfast? Well, she had candy for breakfast.
Yeah.
So, come on. So she ended up in the timeout chair 8 times. I would, too, if I had candy for breakfast.
Yeah, I mean, and sometimes that's why we always say, you know, what happened before that?
Right.
What happened before that?
Exactly.
Because sometimes it's something so simple.
I know.
And
yeah.
And sometimes it's not simple at all, but sometimes it is really simple.
Yeah.
And but as you know, as a parent, especially, I think especially if you were raised in a very strict, controlling household.
As I was,
stuff
yes.
like this, like giving your kid the benefit of the doubt, letting it go when they tell you shut up. I mean, it's really hard to do. I'm not.
Yes.
I'm not gonna try and pretend that this is like.
No.
You know that it's easy, or it's easy
I know.
To. You don't want your kid to be a brat. You don't want your kid to
no.
be spoiled. No matter what their issues are, you don't want them to be spoiled. You want them to be the best they can be. Blah blah blah. So it's really hard to kind of dial back on all these automatic things that we do as a parent
yeah.
to try to mold them and change them.
Yeah.
But I think that if you're in a situation where you literally can't see the, not literally, where you can't see the
yeah.
forest for the trees, because there's so many behaviors going on and you can't really figure out, like, what is on purpose and what is not on purpose.
Right.
If you can tamp down your own responses, and you can give them the benefit of the doubt, and you can let things go, it actually will create the situation where then you can really start to separate it out. And it's counterintuitive to do that.
Yep.
But it
yep.
does work.
Yeah.
It does.
yeah. No, I know it does. And I think, you know, but I do feel for, I don't, you know, I was a parent of two little boys at one time. They're now 23 and 26, so my life is a little easier. It's not nirvana, but it's a little easier. I remember when they were little, and I remember getting caught in that trap, you know, because
right.
I was raised in a very controlling, you know, family where we had to obey. And no matter what, that kind of stays with you, and, you know, not being disrespectful. And I got caught up sometimes too much in that semantics rather than really stepping back and thinking, what is really going on here? Because when my boys were very young, I was younger and didn't have the tools that I needed at that time to be understanding and just step back from the situation. So this is what I try. I talk about all my mistakes because I think that's a good way for people to learn, you know. It's not good to be yelling and screaming at your children all the time because I know you're frustrated and angry, but it doesn't help the situation at all. So
And if we had, I mean, we made a lot of mistakes too. That's why this has worked so well for us, is because we really messed it up, and then we had to pull it back. If we had kind of been understanding from the get-go, I think, and actually there's a lot of anecdotal evidence to suggest that, is if you have a child who has brain differences, and this is identified early, this is certainly the case with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, if it's identified early, and if parents are educated and the family is supported, outcomes for those kids are much, much better than for kids who aren't identified early and who don't have that.
Yes.
I mean, it seems obvious, but I mean,
it's
really
also
true.
Obvious with ADHD. When they're diagnosed young, then they do better than when they're diagnosed. When they're diagnosed as adolescents, like 17, 16, 17, 18, that's a very difficult time. It's a very, for kids to be diagnosed.
Right, well, because they've experienced chronic failure up until then.
Right.
So listen,
I have some questions from people that they post to my website. So this first question is there some kind of medications that are used in conjunction with this disorder?
Let me see how I can answer that question. So many times people who have fetal alcohol exposure do take medications, you know, kind of your stimulant medications, mood medications, but this is really an individual thing. So I can't say like, you know, Ritalin works or whatever. It has to do with the individual. There's also people with fetal alcohol, you know, their brains are organized differently, and they're down, even possibly down to the cellular level, they're different. So the reactions to medications might be quite different than people who have a more typical brain structure.
Right.
So it's, you know, it's just kind of a hit or miss kind of thing.
Okay.
I mean, my son has been on many different medications, and one of the great thing about understanding him better and really using this approach is we've been able to drop a lot of the medications that he's been on, because he was on them basically to kind of manage the symptoms of frustration and, you know, chronic failure and you know, his experience of the world. And now that's not his every minute experience. He doesn't really need those medications.
That's great. That's really great.
Also, we took him out of school too, which helped.
Yeah, because you're homeschooling him, so he has more successes.
We don't have to like sit.
No.
Sit down.
I mean,
and
I just
quiet. That's
and
not,
you know, it's the same thing in my world with psychotropic medications. You know, I certainly could tell somebody, yes, when I was on Adderall, it worked great for me, and then somebody else goes on it and they're in the emergency room, you know?
Right.
So
I mean, so the answer is yes, there are medications that could be helpful for individuals, but no, there's no one medication recommended for people with FA. And in fact, you should probably proceed with caution because it can impact people differently. And the other part is that the majority of psychiatrists and family doctors and who, I mean, I hope if you have a person with FA and you're going to the doctor, you're going to a psychiatrist or someone and
right.
not just like, you know, your general practitioner, because it
right.
is much more complicated. But most of them don't understand fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. There's very little education about it. And so,
it's so
just to be careful and not, just to be careful, I think.
Wow. Okay.
I'm not
anti-medication
by any means.
Right. No, I'm not either, but I just think that, careful. So here's the next question. This is a good one.
Yes.
How do you deal with adolescents and young adults who have this particular processing issue that we've been talking about? I think it's a good question because there's going to be things as adolescents and young adults that we're going to hear that we may not process. And do you know anything about how do we deal with that?
Well, what I guess I don't understand by how do we deal, like how do parents deal?
How does the person deal with it, or how do the parents deal with it if it's an adolescent?
Okay. Well, one strategy is if you have a child with FA or with processing, if you're parenting someone with processing issues, or if you're working with someone processing issues, or if you're a person who has processing issues, the number one thing is to slow down.
Okay.
Right? So quit talking so fast.
Right.
Quit talking so much. Quit using so many words. If the person is really unable to understand you at the speed you're delivering information, you need to think of a different way to do it, right? So slow down, use fewer words, maybe if there can be visual things that you can do. I mean, because it's the processing speed isn't really something that you can necessarily speed up.
No,
I
right.
mean, there might
be some
awesome therapy out there that can magically do
right.
it for some people. But really, the key is just to, you know, just slow it down. My son said something really.
I think
the
other thing, too, is I think if you have an adolescent or, you know, you're an adult that has this mm-hmm. issue, I think you got to get some help with this. And if you have a processing issue, then you've got to go to somebody that possibly can help you a little bit. And, yes, you have to slow down when you're talking to the person. I understand that part of it. But also I think they need to understand, like you and I were just talking about, when you're diagnosed later on in life.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
and if this particular person that asked this question is someone who was diagnosed later on in life, then
mm-hmm.
they need to have the tools themselves
right.
to deal with
right.
it.
Right.
Yeah.
Like I think we all have these issues to a certain extent. And so how do we express this? I'm someone
right.
who I can process perfectly quickly if I'm speaking one-on-one to someone. But the minute two people start speaking to me, forget it. I can't pay attention to either one. And
right.
so, you know, I've learned to say to people, like, I need one at a time. I really, really need, and it's not because I think you're rude. It's because, although you are being rude. No, but it's I need one person. I can't listen to more than one person at once. So if
right.
you're a person who has problems with processing speed, like audio processing,
right.
you're going to need to learn to tell people what you need in a way that they'll understand, you know, like slow down or I don't understand or explain that another way or, you know, that kind of thing.
Right. No, yeah, that's good. And I think they really need to go and search out some help for themselves, too, especially if they're older, you know. I think it's important.
Mm-hmm.
So here's another one. Is there a difference in behavior between boys and girls with the spectrum?
Oh, I don't know if there's any research on that. I have anecdotal information, though. And
okay.
that is that many, many boys with FA, if they get upset about something, they tend to be more aggressive, so they express outward, right?
Okay.
Many many girls with FA might tend to express it inward if they're upset. I mean, I think that kind of mirrors just men
yeah.
and women in general,
yeah.
right? So So if you have a child who's chronically frustrated, if it's a boy, he might become aggressive. He might scream, swear, throw things, perhaps become violent. A girl
right.
might become depressed, right?
Okay.
But
yeah, inward, yeah.
That's anecdotal. That's anecdotal.
Okay.
There might be some research on it, but I don't have it kind of in my brain file at the moment.
Okay. Now, I don't know if you answered this in the beginning, but I have this question. How do you determine if your child has FA or something else?
So fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, one determining factor is, do you know if that person has been exposed to alcohol
okay.
in utero? I mean, that,
okay.
that'll kind of, you know, point you in a direction. Sometimes people know, like they'll have a child who's adopted, and they'll know that child has been exposed to alcohol or other substances in utero, and they'll want to divide out, like, what is the fetal alcohol, or it doesn't have to be adopted kids, it could be any kid, right?
Right.
What is the fetal alcohol part of it, the attachment part of it, you know, what's the this part of it? And I think that people want to do that because a lot of times different approaches are suggested for the different disorders. But
okay.
When I talk about fetal alcohol, I talk about it as a whole brain approach
right.
versus, those blind men and the elephant, where one blind man's touching the side of the elephant and he says, this is a wall, and then one of them touches the tail and he says, no, it's a rope, and then the other one has the nose, he says, this is a hose. I think it's better to think of the whole elephant.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, no, that's
those
good.
Different parts.
That's a very
so,
good point.
Without knowing more about what this person is asking, I would say that I guess I would want to know why.
Well, they go on to ask. Well, they go on to ask: is there a specific test or testing that can be done, and who would do it? A general doctor
oh,
or a psychiatrist?
Okay, yeah. Right. To be diagnosed with fetal alcohol spectrum
yes.
disorder, yes. So yes, there's not a specific test. What they do is a diagnosis has a bunch of different criteria. And the weird thing about fetal alcohol is different clinics around the country use different standards for diagnosis. But to have a full fetal alcohol syndrome, you need to have facial features. This is full fetal alcohol syndrome. This is not, you know, the 95% of people who don't have full fetal alcohol syndrome but who had exposure.
Okay.
You need to have facial anomalies, and you can look those up on the internet. There's tons of pictures of
okay.
the facial anomalies. You need to have central nervous system involvement,
okay.
Which means you need to have some kind of brain difference, and they know that through neuropsychological testing.
Okay.
You also, to have full fetal alcohol syndrome, so you need to have three of these four, I have to say, for full fetal alcohol syndrome. You need to have growth inhibition.
Okay.
And you need to have proof of maternal alcohol consumption. Some FASD clinics do not require proof of maternal alcohol consumption. Some do. To have be diagnosed with one of the FASDs, so there's a bunch of different diagnostic terms, and actually the DSM-5 has just come out with a new, they finally have included FASD in the DSM-5. It hadn't been before. In order to have one of those, the criteria are different, but it always involves central nervous system involvement. And right now, diagnosis is done by geneticists. It's a diagnosis of exclusion. But
okay.
now that it's in the DSM-5, once psychiatrists and clinical social workers become more aware and educated on it, they will be able to diagnose. But if the person asking that is interested in pursuing a diagnosis, I recommend finding a multimodal clinic near you. So
okay.
not just one individual doctor. It needs to be a clinic. So they involve the OT, the speech and language pathologist, the neuropsych, and the geneticist. So don't just take
Would they Google that, like multimodal clinic for fetal alcohol?
I would look up FASD clinic.
Okay.
People can also we're starting a nonprofit around this, and if people want to post questions on our Facebook page, we will answer them. Nonprofit is Families Affected by Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorder, so FASD. And like I said, we have a Facebook page, and people will help you find the nearest clinic to you
that they recommend.
Yeah, there's not one in every state. And
okay.
then some are more people, you know, parents and professionals have opinions about the different clinics, and we'll just have to let them share it. You know, it's always good to kind of have firsthand opinions, I think.
Yes. Yes.
What to expect.
And
yeah.
I think what you just said is really excellent for them to find a multimodal clinic.
Yeah, multimodal,
right,
because you don't want to just go. So when our son was in the process, we decided we wanted to pursue a diagnosis, I live in central North Carolina, and our nearest, we live near a bunch of excellent hospitals. We live near Duke, and we live near UNC hospitals.
Wow.
And on the National Organization of Fetal Alcohol Syndrome, they listed the UNC genetics department as a place you could get diagnosis. So, of course, I thought, oh, well, that's 20 minutes from my house. Of course, we're going to go there. So I got an appointment, you know, and since it's a university hospital, we had to wait 8 months, of course. And
of course.
So a month before we're supposed to get the diagnosis, I get an appointment card in the mail, and it says the name of the doctor, and I look her up, and she is a pediatric ear specialist. And
no.
I was like, that's weird. So I called the office, and I said, do you guys want at my, because we've had a neuropsych done, I said, do you want our neuropsych report? You know, do you want any of the information from my son's psychiatrist? And they said, nope, we don't need any of that. So then I thought, oh, okay. Because by then, 8 months later, I had educated myself enough so that I thought,
right.
this doesn't sound great. So then I made an appointment with our multimodal clinic. And that was better because we got the, you know, they did an OT eval as part of
right.
it. They looked at our neuropsych results. They interviewed me, the social worker who ran the clinic interviewed me, and she did the Vineland Adaptive Behavior Scale, which looks at developmental age and adaptive behavior, and it's a standardized test that is very helpful with me. You know, they interviewed me, they looked at all our paperwork, they talked to his teachers, et cetera, so it was just a much more thorough evaluation.
Comprehensive, yeah.
Yeah, and it told us more in the end than if we'd gone to this ear specialist who I'm not.
Can you imagine?
I mean, she was qualified to diagnose, right? I don't want to.
Right.
I don't want to say anything bad about her because she's a geneticist and she's qualified to diagnose, but it's not her area of expertise.
Right.
And I needed, you know, I wanted. You should take them to people for whom this is their area of expertise.
Yeah,
because
exactly
there's
right.
so much, there's such a lack of knowledge in the rest of the medical community that you can't assume, you know, you just can't assume anything. So you should,
no,
if
you
can take them to a specialty clinic, you should take them to a
yes.
specialty clinic.
I agree. I can't believe that our time is up. This went
what?
By so fast. Yeah, this was so much fun having you on. You just have a wealth of information, and I would love to have you on again sometime if you'd be willing to do that. I think that would
be
great.
Well, sure, Justine, that would be fine. Yeah.
Okay. Well,
and so
thank
people,
you so much.
If people do have more questions, they should definitely post them on that the Facebook page, or people can email me too. I imagine you have my contact information somewhere.
I tell you what, if you send it to my website, to my email, I can post it on my website and on my Facebook page.
I will.
All
do
right.
That.
This way, if people are there on mine, then they can see it.
Okay, I'll do that.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
It was great spending time with you, and I will,
great,
I'm sure,
so
be in touch soon.
Okay, thanks.
Have a great
Bye-bye.
Sunday.
Bye-bye.
Sure. Bye.
And I want to say goodbye to everybody who's listening. And, again, just remind everybody about my support group on Wednesday nights in Torrance, California. And I want everybody to please stay in the moment. I promise we will be back next week. Have a great Sunday.